Is that okay? I seem to have two microphones, so I'll be in stereo. thanks very much, Don, for that introduction, and thanks very much, everyone, for having me up and asking me to speak at the conference today. I have to say, listening to Aunt, it was Aunt Sally, is that right?
Aunt Carol, sorry.
Shivering up here. And being out last night with Don and Shelley, shivering, took me back a bit to some childhood memories of my grandmother's cousins. My grandmother's cousins who were from Queensland. When she was 18 or something, her parents and her 12 brothers and sisters moved from Tasmania to Thangool, or as we learnt to call it from them, Thangool. And they used to regularly visit in summer to go and see their cousin Amy in Tasmania. And did they freeze, the poor things? They'd think it was summer, and so they'd come down in their big floral dresses and their shorts and T-shirts, and they'd, oh, it's so cold in Tasmania. So, of course, what we did was that, as you might know, sometimes around Christmas time in Tasmania, it snows in the Highlands, which is very delightful. And we'd say, do you want to see some snow? And they go, yeah, we've never seen snow. Doesn't snow much in Thangool. And so we'd take them up into the snow and undo the door of the camper van, and they'd jump out like deer and run into the snow and roll around. Not realising, of course, that we'd taken bets about how long they'd be in there, in the snow. And Dad would say, oh, I reckon I'd give them about 30 seconds. And Mum would say, oh, no, they'll be there for longer, at least a minute. And so we'd all be looking at our watches, counting down how long it was before our cousins from Queensland would spring back into the camper van. Oh! We didn't realise it was this cold. But I have to admit, after a day now of mocking Shelley and Don and others for saying how cold it is a bit cold. Today I want to talk a bit about something that I really love and is important to me. I've already started talking about it a bit. And of course that's Tasmania. On May the 1st this year, we commemorated the 10th anniversary of the decriminalisation of homosexuality in Tasmania on the 1st of May 1997. And that was a time for us to recall how much Tasmania had changed in that 10 years. As you might know, Tasmania was the last state to decriminalise homosexuality in 1997 after an awful history of pretty terrible persecution and discrimination against gay, lesbian, bisexual and transgender people. 10 years on, Tasmania now has some of the best anti-discrimination and relationship laws not only in Australia but in the world. We have some of the best policies and programs, particularly in areas like education, where recently the state government announced a mandatory 6-week anti-homophobia program for all secondary schools in Tasmania, funded by the Education Department. Attitudes in Tasmania have also changed in that 10 years. When I came out, support for decriminalising homosexuality was 15% below the national average. 10 years on, it was 15% above, higher in Hobart than it was in Sydney or Melbourne, with 70% support for the relationship laws that we have now. Not in Hobart, not even in Launceston, but in Ulverston and Burnie and Devonport, where my grandmother used to receive her cousins from Queensland, and where I grew up. The best illustrations of this change, like I said, are the recent announcements about education reform, recent responses to some anti-gay hate in a small town called Penguin, where all major political parties, all the newspapers, all the community leaders denounced it, spoke against anti-gay hate in a way that I found amazing, because many of those people, or at least their predecessors 10 years ago, were the people who were inciting just that kind of hate. And perhaps the most extraordinary sign of change for me was a man called David Foster. I don't know if you know that name, but he's very important in Tasmania because he's the world champion axeman. He has more world champion, titles in wood chopping than anyone else in the entire world. He's a very big man. He's a very big personality and a very big person. He can chop through a tree in just one stroke, like this. He's a Tasmanian icon. And in the 1990s, he was unfortunately extremely homophobic and spoke out against gay and lesbian rights at every opportunity. And when this anti-gay hate came up in Penguin recently, he spoke out against that. He wrote a newspaper column and he said, look, I was a bigot, I was the biggest bigot under the sun, and I've changed because I can see now that I was wrong, and I can see now that people around me have changed. We've all changed. It's time to move on. And he wrote at length about gay and lesbian youth suicide, the importance of education programs, all this kind of thing. And I have to say, just thinking about it now actually, that reading that made me cry a bit, because I thought, if David Foster can change, then anything can change. Now, the obvious question that people ask themselves is, how did this happen? How did Tasmania go from a place that was 10 years ago a byword for intolerance? Tasmania was called Bigots Island in the international press, to being another word now for inclusion and acceptance. It's an important question because it has a bearing on the future of the entire country. While Tasmania has changed for the better, of course, in that 10 years, Australia has changed for the worse. Where once we were, as a nation, considered quite tolerant on questions of sexual and gender diversity, we now have some of the worst laws at a national level in the Western world. Asking the question how Tasmania has changed is not only has a bearing on how Australia might change, it also has a bearing on the issues that you'll be discussing, because parents in Tasmania had a key role to play in the transformation that we've seen. So, the first answer I have for you today when it comes to how did Tasmania change is the issue of the issues that we focused on. There are 1,000 injustices in this world. There's a million different worthy causes that we could focus on. But there are some issues I've found in my 20 years as an activist upon which our lives and upon which history swing. I call them pivot issues. Take the issue of black people sitting at the back of the bus in Alabama in the 1950s. It was just one example amongst many of racism at that time in that place. But for some reason, that was the issue that set the world alight. Saving the Franklin River in southwest Tasmania in the 1980s with another such issue. The Franklin River was just one river amongst many that were scheduled to be dammed. It was a remote river in a remote part of the world, but for some reason, that issue, again, set the world alight. The decriminalisation of homosexuality in Tasmania was a similar issue. Allowing gay men in little old Tasmania to have sex in the privacy of their own bedrooms, that doesn't seem very important when you put it that way. But for some reason, that issue attracted the attention of the world. It inspired thousands of people, thousands, to rally and march and write letters. And it changed the lives of many, many people, gay and straight. It became a stage, if you like, upon which Tasmania played out its many frustrations and tensions. It became a national, political and constitutional battleground. It changed the human rights agenda globally through the United Nations case that we took against those laws. And like I said, it affected many people beyond just a few gay men. My advice to anyone seeking to change things, wanting to improve the world, is to find those issues that mean the most to you and mean the most to other people. that have meanings and importance beyond themselves, that, if you like, can become metaphors for something greater. Issues upon which your world pivots and the world of others. Issues which you can work with others on, share a passion on, and achieve great change with. Once you've found that particular issue, it's very important to keep it, of course, in front of the public and at the forefront of public debate. In Tasmania, there's a generation of examples of how we did this. But today I'll just refer to one, because I think it illustrates some of the points that I'm talking about. It's 1994. The United Nations, as I've already mentioned, has just decided that Tasmania's laws against gay sex violate the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Australia is in breach of its international obligations. There's a big national debate about this, particularly focusing on whether the federal government has the right to override the states and whether the UN has the right to tell us what to do and whether troops will be sent in with blue helmets to get the Tasmanian Parliament to do the right thing. We decide that we want to return this big, sprawling debate to the issue that we think is most important, and that is the lives of gay men. So we decide that we will turn ourselves into the police, that we will break the law, by which, of course, I mean have sex in the privacy of our bedrooms, write it all down in a statutory declaration, which wasn't easy, I can tell you. Particularly wasn't easy finding someone to sign it. I've got a heterosexual friend who is a Justice of the Peace, and I said, would you sign this for me as a Justice of the Peace? And she said, yes, but I don't ever tell anyone this, but I'm not going to read it. The idea, of course, was that we would present these to the police, and that the police would either arrest us, in which case the weight of world opinion would come down on top of the Tasmanian government's head, hopefully, or the police wouldn't arrest us, in which case we could say, what's the point of having these ridiculous laws? So for us, it was a win-win situation. But as good as it looked on paper, it was pretty scary. We'd spend our lives as gay Tasmanians trying to avoid the police, and here we were going straight into the lion's den. I remember the night that I was called in for questioning about my statement. I remember it very clearly. It was a Saturday night because here I was in an interview room with the harsh fluoro lights and an older burly sergeant and a younger constable. And it was Saturday night because I usually watch The Bill. And in The Bill, there's always an interview scene. And here I was in the interview scene. And the older sergeant said to me, now, Mr. Croom, says here in your statement that you were awoken by an alarm clock at 7 a.m. Can you please tell us what you were doing before 7 a.m. and what you were wearing? Well, I was asleep and I wasn't wearing anything. I was in bed. It says, according to the statement, that you and the co-accused, Mr. Toonan, who was my partner at the time of 7 years, were engaged in criminal activity. It says here that you were in position A and then moved to position B. Can you tell us, please, how you got from position A to position B? And whether you were still, as you said before, without any apparel? Well, yeah, okay. Yes, and I still didn't have any clothes on. No, that's right. Can you tell us, please, how many times you have committed this offence with the co-accused? And where? Can you please supply us with a list of addresses? So I had to quickly calculate, okay, we've been together for 7 years, maybe 3 times a week, that's about 1,000 times. And this is a very good example of why you should not trust journalists. The next day, the correspondent for The Australian in Hobart was talking to me about this, and we'd made an agreement beforehand that we were not going to talk about the details of the stat decks because we didn't want the press that to become the issue. We didn't want salacious headlines. And this guy got, he was talking about it, and then he sort of got friendly. I mean, we knew each other for a long time, and he said, so how many times did you tell them then? And I was just off guard for that second, and I said, oh, I think about 1,000 times or so. Next day in the Australian, big headline, activist admits there were sex 1,000 times. Just imagine how embarrassing that was. Although it probably didn't do my sexual credibility any harm. Later on, it was only later on that I was able to sort of sit back and think about those questions. Why did the police ask me those bizarre questions? And I realised that it was because in their eyes, according to Tasmanian law, I was a serious criminal. The activity to which I had admitted carried a greater penalty, 21 years in jail, maximum penalty, than rape or armed robbery, which is 14 years in jail. In their eyes, I was the equivalent, legally, of a rapist or an armed robber because of my loving same-sex relationship. And even though I'd been campaigning for that reform for 6 years, I think it was at that moment that I realised what a true tragedy those laws were. Now, as it happened, the police didn't arrest us. They decided it was too hot for them to handle. I think one of the reasons they did that was it wasn't just gay men who handed themselves in. There were others, including a father of a gay man who filled out a stat deck and gave it to the police. And when asked why he was involved, he said, "That man is my son." And I knowingly allowed him to break the law with his partner under my roof. Arrest me. I'm an accomplice. The police weren't going to arrest him. So they told us, they said, "You're not arrested." And I think that was the moment, that was one of the key moments, if not the moment, when I knew those laws were going to go. When that news was broadcast on the TV that night, the police would not arrest us. It was as if you could hear hundreds of thousands of people across the island going, "We've been dragged before international courts on this. We've been made a laughing stock. Every time we go to Sydney and Melbourne, people make fun of us, even more than they used to." And all that for laws that they're not even going to enforce. What's the point of this? I think that was a key moment. Beyond all these high-profile actions and media stories, I think one of the most significant causes of change in Tasmania has been community education. In my experience, all the most meaningful and substantial change comes from below, from ordinary people whose lives are affected by the need for change. For almost 20 years, ordinary gay and lesbian Tasmanians and their children and their parents and their friends have been travelling around the state addressing church groups and rotary clubs and political party branch meetings and whoever would listen. Now, the change from this kind of advocacy is slow. It accumulates slowly. Although it is maximised when there is the kind of high-profile debate in the media that I've been talking about, because people read the newspaper, see the TV, they go, "What's this about?" And then in comes a group of people to talk about it. It really heightens the effect on people's hearts and minds, as does the fact that if it's localised, it has a big effect. And in Tasmania, of course, people are pretty interconnected. And if you go to a small town and you talk to one group or another, inevitably people will talk to each other, you'll get invitations to other groups if you're good speakers, and you'll find quite amazing change happening in a relatively short period in those small communities. Never assume, particularly that the small rural communities are unchangeable. In Tasmania, I've seen small towns go from having a reputation to being the most intolerant places to welcoming gay and lesbian people with outstretched arms. The two most recent examples of the impact of our advocacy have been the relationship reform in Tasmania, relationship law reform, and also the education reform I mentioned. Both of these featured gay and lesbian people and their children and their parents. Some people out there don't understand the details of law reform. They don't understand the details of school curriculum, but everyone understands love. The love between two partners or the love between a parent and a child. And I'll give you one short example of this. During the relationships debate in Tasmania, the Anglican bishop, Bishop Harawa, at the start of the debate, was quite negative, with all the usual stuff about, you know, children really need a mother and a father, and I'm against this, and I don't really think we should have a relationship registry because that's too much like marriage, and blah, 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 blah. But he's a sincere man, so I just rang him and said, look, Bish, no, I didn't, Your Grace, would you like to meet some people who are affected by this? And he said, yes, I will. So we arranged for him to come and meet a lesbian couple and their three children and three of their parents. So you've got three generations. And you could see the change happening. They were talking about their lives. They were talking about their aspirations. They were people that he might have had in his congregation and, you know, people he'd meet every day. And I could see it on his face that he was understanding things that he'd never thought of before. I knew something was going to happen, although I didn't think it would be as big as it was. For a couple of months, he didn't say anything publicly. He avoided public comment. And I thought, oh, that's great. At least he's not saying the negative things that he was. And then just before the debate in the Legislative Council, our up house, you're lucky you don't have such a thing here, where the vote was tied very close about whether we would have equal rights for same-sex couples in Tasmanian law. And without any fanfare, in fact, I didn't discover it until after the debate, he wrote to the key members, the people who hadn't made up their minds, some of whom were Anglicans, and he said, look, I know I said that I didn't like this reform, but I was wrong. And this is why I was wrong, and I think you should vote for it. And they did. Sometimes it seems like it's all uphill. Like no matter how hard we try, we can't make a difference. But when you go through something like that, you realise that change is possible, quite miraculous change, and that it's up to us. So in conclusion, if I'm right and that there are some issues upon which our lives and upon which history pivots and which hold out the renewal, hold out the promise of a renewal of entire communities and of entire societies, just like decriminalisation did in Tasmania, just like it was a kind of dam that was breached and outflowed all this great law reform and policy, are there any such issues waiting in the wings to offer some renewal and change for Australia as a whole? Now, like I said, there are many different injustices demanding our attention, and rightly so. And in a couple of weeks, like Shelley mentioned, the Human Rights Commission will come out with a report on the hundreds of areas of federal law where same-sex couples, de facto couples, are still discriminated against. And it's very important that we all read that and that we absorb that and that we support that and take action on it. Another issue that I'm involved in is blood donation, discrimination in blood donation. At the moment, gay and bisexual men, no matter how safe their sexual activity, aren't allowed to give blood, whereas heterosexuals who may be quite promiscuous and have unsafe sex are. There's a young gay man from Launceston who is challenging that in the Tasmanian Anti-Discrimination Commission, and there'll be hearings of that later in the year. And I think he has a strong case, and I'm very much supportive of what he's doing. That's just another example of the kind of discrimination I'm talking about. But beyond all those issues, those hundreds of issues, there's one which I believe offers Australia the same kind of catharsis that Tasmania has had, and that issue is same-sex marriage. The issue is engaging and it's sometimes polarising. This is because marriage is an institution that everyone is familiar with, has a history with, has knowledge of, has some kind of investment in. History shows that campaigns for equality within marriage, be it for women having equality within marriage or Aboriginal people being able to decide who they marry and not being told by the authorities, or black people in the United States or whatever it was, the broader movements for emancipation for those groups have pivoted on that right to self-determination and equality and freedom within marriage. Now, I'm not saying that's the reason to support same-sex marriage. It stands on its own merits as an issue of equality. I'm simply saying that I think that will be the issue that uplifts this country in the next few years, that makes us sit back and reflect on how tolerant we really are and gives us a prompt to become more so. But as with all human rights issues and everything I've mentioned today, this can't be achieved without the help of allies. Tasmania shows that the world can change, but it also shows that it can't be done without all of us working together. On many occasions, if you're a parent of a gay, lesbian, bisexual or transgender person, your child has turned to you. When they were bruised at school, they turned to you, even if they didn't and weren't able to tell you why it was. When they came out, they turned to you, even though you may have been hurting just as much as they were. When our first relationship ended, we turned to you, even though you may not have really understood what was going on. And now we turn to you again. We need you, perhaps as much as we ever have. We need you to help us achieve full and equal rights as Australian citizens. It may be the hardest thing we've ever asked of you, but in the long term, it will be the most important for all of us. Thank you.